Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, if you've got your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and find Revelation chapter 6. As we'll continue moving through as we continue moving through the book of Revelation, I know we've taken a couple weeks off, and so we need to kind of catch up where we've been, so that way we'll kind of have a good idea of where we're going to land today. So let's kind of recap just for a few minutes. So over the last couple weeks, as we've been looking through Revelation, we've seen in chapter one that John gives us the key to understanding the entire book of Revelation. And so that key comes actually in the very first verse where it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ. And we saw that the way that's phrased, we're supposed to understand that Jesus owns the revelation, it's His, and that He's the star of the show. It's about Him. So the entire book of Revelation, Jesus owns it, and it's about Him. Just so whenever you're at home, and whenever you're reading Revelation, and you get like deep in it, and you're like, what in the world is going on? Just remember, He owns it, and it's about Him, right? He owns it, it's about Him. In the middle chapters, chapters 2 and 3, Jesus addresses several churches, and He has a specific message to each and every one of those churches, and we went through those. In chapter 4 and 5, Jesus John receives this great picture of heaven. And in chapter 4, it's all focused on who is seated on the throne, i.e. God the Father. And the picture that's painted is magnificent. It's hard to describe. And it's filled with a prismatic color, a multicolored rainbow around the throne, or halo around the throne. And there's something like as if a sea of glass existed in front. And there's all these people around the throne. And all of it is about worshiping the one who's seated on the throne, God the Father. And then chapter 5, we saw this wonderful picture of Jesus, who at first is presented as this lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David. But when John turns around to see Jesus, he doesn't see a lamb, but what does he see? Or doesn't see a lion, but what does he see? A lamb as if it was slaughtered. A standing lamb as if it was slaughtered, i.e. referring back to Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. And then all of heaven worships the lion lamb Jesus as well. And that gets us to chapter 6, where we'll be reading this morning. And just so you know, we kind of got to go over a few little tidbits just to kind of get us in the right frame of mind. So we've had all of that leads up to chapter 6. And chapter 5 ends with this image of Jesus and this scroll and like who can open it. And then that's when John finds out that Jesus is worthy to open the scroll, but we don't know what's in the scroll. And so today in chapter 6, Jesus, we're about to find out what's in the scroll. Jesus is about to show us what's in the scroll. But chapter 6 through chapter 19, so that's the biggest chunk of the book of Revelation, chapter 6 starts what is called, listen to the words, judgment cycle. Okay? Judgment cycle. Now, the reason I use the word cycle, okay, now listen to me. You and I are linear thinkers. You with me? A, then what comes after A? B, then F? No, D, E, F, G, H, all the way to Z, right? We are linear thinkers. If I were to say, look, when I was growing up, my mom and dad both worked the early shift at the Air Force Base in Warner Robins. And so many, many, many mornings I got dropped off at my grandma's house. Sometimes I went back to sleep. Then I got woke up. She had breakfast. Hard-boiled egg, pecan twirl, Sunny D, mini sausage biscuit. It was great. Okay, I didn't eat the yellow part of the hard-boiled egg as a kid because like that's gross. It's like eating chalk, right? So the white of the hard-boiled egg, a mini sausage biscuit, Pecan Twirl, Sunny D, right? And as I was got into sports more, I watched ESPN every morning. And on Fridays, I love Fridays. You know why? They have the top 10. Top 10 moments on ESPN. And you know what number they started at? 10. And what was the best one? Was it number 5? It was number 1. You want to know why? Because we are linear thinkers, right? Chapter 6 through 19 does not progress in a linear fashion. It progresses in a cyclical fashion. That means, listen to me, we're going to see, if you stay with us long enough and you keep coming back, from today till we get to chapter 19, we're going to see three cycles that deal like this. That, guess what? Almost tell the exact same story over and over and over again. You want to know why? Because the people that John was writing to are cyclical thinkers, not necessarily linear thinkers. Now, I've got a little chart. We're not going to go to the chart. We're not going to pull it up. I've got a chart on your outline that has chapters 6, I believe, and 7, and then 8 and 9, I believe, or 8, 9, and 10. And it's the what we're talking about, the seals, which we're going to talk about today. Most people would refer to this, most pastors would be the seal judgments and then the trumpet judgments. But if you'll notice, look how they're laid out. These two sets, these first two cycles are laid out what? Identically. Right? One cycle, two cycles. And chapter 12 starts the third cycle. Right? Now, if you let me say, I don't know about this, Pastor. All right, got another thing for you. This is your homework for this week. I want you to go back and read the latter half of the book of Mark. The latter half of the book of Mark. So you're going to see this story. I believe it's in chapter 8, if memory serves me correct. This is just off the top of my head. Chapter 8. Jesus heals this guy. And it's the only time where Jesus has to touch somebody twice to heal him. He's got an eye issue, and Jesus like spits and makes mud and rubs it on his eyes, and Jesus asked him, can you see? And then he says, well, I see men, but they look like trees, and Jesus does it again, right? And he's healed, right? And then Jesus asked the disciples this question, and from that point forward, Jesus leaves the masses and spends pretty much the rest of the book with his disciples. And here's what you'll see. You'll see cycles of this right here. Here's what Jesus does. Hey, guys, I'm going to die. But don't worry, I'm going to rise again. Oh, no, you're not, Jesus. That's the disciples' response. And then Jesus takes a good chunk and he teaches them what it means to be a disciple. And then guess what happens? Guess what, guys? Hey, not going to be here much longer. Oh, we would die for you. Well, wait a minute, guys. Here's what it means to be a disciple. Guess what, guys? I'm going to die. 3 days later. No, you're not. Then what does Jesus do? Teaches them what it means to be a disciple. Now, why does Mark write these? Why didn't he just do it once? Because they're what? Cyclical thinkers. And so Mark shows these three cycles. Guess what John does? Seal cycle, trumpet cycle, and then chapter 12 through 19 is the dragon cycle. And so there are three cycles that tell almost the same story. I'm going to totally steal my own thunder, because when we get to the end of the seal number 6 today, it's going to sound a lot like the end of the world. But what? Does the book of Revelation end in chapter 6? Nope. Why? Three cycles. I say all of that for you to get in your mind this morning that from this point till the point we get to chapter 19, we are not necessarily moving from the present day in John's eyes to the end of the world in a straight line. Right? So I say that to say there's no use in going home and getting on the internet and trying to find out if a quarter of the world has died by the sword this year. Or when did this happen? That's not the point. What's the point about? Jesus owns Revelation, and it's all about Him. All right, now let's begin. All right, we're going to read the first 8 verses all at one time. Here we go. Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the 7 seals, and I heard one of the 4 living creatures with a voice like thunder, come. And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come," and out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. He opened the third seal. I heard the third living creature say, "Come," and I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Verse 7, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the fourth living creature say, "Come," and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and with wild beasts of the earth. So what have we just read about? The four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? So you can go back and you can Google this online. There, from medieval times, people, artists were painting pictures of these four horsemen of the apocalypse. Now, I got a funny story about this, right? So when I was first in ministry, down in Butler, just a few miles south, a few minutes south of us here, down Highway 19, our church decided to take a group over to LaGrange. I don't remember what church it was, but we went to the Judgment Journey, Tribulation Trail. I don't remember what the name of it was. But let me just tell you that whatever church over in LaGrange, I think they may still do it, they spared no expense on this deal. I had no idea what I was walking into. I was fresh in ministry, literally not been there long, and my pastor's like, "Hey, let's take some teenagers over to this thing. Maybe they'll get saved." And I was like, "Okay, let's go." So we loaded up our two church vans. I'm surprised one of them even made it over there and back, but we made it. And when we get there, long story short, you start out in the church, and there's like tea and coffee and, you know, refreshments and all, because it's cold, right? It's at Halloween, but it is like cold. And so we go out, and they have a lot of property, and this thing takes place at various parts of I forgot to mention this part. It is dark. And when you get out in the property, it is like walking through the woods with no light in the middle of the night, right? And you have a guide, like there's a person from the church who like guides you, and there's scenes set up, and you walk through all the scenes. And the first one, I mean, I've got teenagers, like in my group that I'm in, and we're like, because there's so many of us, we have split up groups. And so I'm in this group with teenagers, teenage girls, significantly, girls, some boys in there too. And we just stop, and we're in the middle of the woods, and it is dark, like you got to get real close. And all of a sudden you hear, it's my best horse impression. And I'm like, "Oh, okay, I know what's happening." And then it gets louder and louder and louder, and I'm like, "Man, this is some good acoustics they got going on out here." And then all of a sudden, you hear the, and I look up, and there's a horse right here. Like, right here. Like, it was four dudes on four real horses riding in the pitch black. And I mean, for those of you who've watched Lord of the Rings, you know the black horses that come after Frodo and how they snort and they throw all the smoke out? It was like right here. I mean, I even got scared, much less the little teenage girls. They were like crawling up the trees trying to get away. Because, I mean, these guys were great horsemen. I mean, they like put the brakes on them suckers. And you know how you watch horses, they stop real quick and the dirt flies up and there's all this. I mean, I was like... I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, you know, this is my first time into this thing, and I'm thinking, this is the first scene. This is about to be wild. Oh my gosh. And it was, I mean, again, it was good. Like, they did a great job throughout the whole thing of production and all that. But that was the opening scene. These four real live horses, and they came out and they spoke the words. Like, we just read, the guy with the sword had a sword. The guy with the scales had a pair of scales in his hand. And you're like, what have I gotten myself into? Right? And so these four horsemen of the apocalypse, like I remember watching a football, an old Notre Dame picture from, they had four running backs at one time, and their four running backs are standing on horses, like the old leather helmets holding the football, right? And what are they called? The four horsemen, right? So this idea is popular in culture, whether it be from football or to just in nomenclature or to the judgment journey over in LaGrange with real horses. Real people, right? And so, but what does John see? John sees them come out like one right after the other, and he sees four of them, right? So let's look at them really quickly. Number one, he sees a white horse, the horse of conquest. The rider has a bow and was given the victor's crown, not like the king's crown, but a victor's crown. The bow is what? A weapon of war. And what does he say he's coming out doing? He is coming out conquering and to conquer. What is this? This is a horse of conquest. The red horse, the red there is a fiery red, and the rider was given a great sword, and he was permitted to take peace. But look at what it says, take peace. But why was he done? So that people should slay one another, right? The black horse had a pair of scales. Now, the prices and the words about, you know, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley and do not harm the oil and wine. Wheat and barley and oil and wine were the staples for a Mediterranean diet. And basically what I read this week is that one denarius, this is pretty common, one denarius equals one day's worth of pay. So if you were a day laborer and you went out in the fields and let's say you picked grapes to make wine or you pressed grapes to make wine, you got paid one denarius. So every day you got paid one. And what this is showing here, the amounts, one quart of wheat or three quarts of barley, wheat was more nutritious than barley was. It basically shows the amount of food it would take to keep one person of average caloric intake alive for one day. So it would either be one quart of wheat or three quarts of barley could keep you of a person of modest appetite alive for one day. So what do we have here? Famine. Famine is what you have. Right, and then the pale horse. Now, whenever we think of pale horse, my dad loved John Wayne and Pale Rider. You know, wasn't that a John Wayne movie? I think it was. Clint Eastwood. I'm sorry. Oh my gosh, tragedy up here. But anyway, we watched it. And you know, the horse was like khaki colored. Well, the word pale here means like puke green. Literally, it's like if you took khaki and split pea soup and put them together. Like that's the color. Right? And who is the rider? Death. And who follows him? Hades. Right? Death and Hades. And so what do we see here? We see that death and Hades are given authority to take out a quarter of the population. So what does all this mean? We could sum it all up in four words. Conquest, famine, death, and disease. One author said that there's a triad of war. You have war, then you have famine, and then you have disease. And whenever you have two, you have the third one. Let's be real today. Look at me. Whatever you think about the Ukraine war, put that aside. If it were not for financial aid given by Western nations, what would be happening in Ukraine right now? Well, there's already war. And what does war bring? Death. And what would be happening if we did not send them food? Famine. And what happens when people are malnourished and there's war and there's death? Disease. You look at conflict after conflict after conflict, and eventually those three things happen. So we have conquest, famine, war, and disease. So what are we supposed to take away from this? Is that as history marches toward the end of time, what's going to happen? War, which brings death, which brings famine, which brings disease. So as history marches on, those four things happen, right? Okay, now, the fifth seal brings about a drastic change in scenery. Read with me in verse number 9. through verse 11. When he opened the fifth, when Jesus, the lion lamb, opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar, so John sees under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on earth? Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete who were to be killed as they themselves had been. All right, so what is verse 5? So you've got the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Conquest, famine, disease, war, death, right? And the fifth seal brings about a dramatic change. So John has seen these horses come out one right after the other. And when Jesus breaks the fifth seal, his attention is turned to the altar. Now, we call, you know, the altar in our colloquial term is like this area right up in here somewhere, you know. But in John's worldview, it's an actual thing that was used for sacrifices, right? For sacrifices. And so both in the Old Testament and in pagan culture, an altar is where you would basically throw an animal as a sacrifice to your deity. In the Old Testament, Moses is given great detail on how to build this altar that goes in the tabernacle, which moves along with the children of Israel. When Solomon builds the temple, they're given great instruction on what this altar should look like. And so John, his attention is drawn to this altar, but he sees souls under the altar, and they say some things. And so what should we take away from that first? Well, the first thing that we should take away is that these souls, as we've seen, or as we read, are representative of people who have died for their faith, giving witness about Jesus. In other words, in chapter 2, when we read about the church at Pergamum, one of those guys is mentioned by name. His name is Antipas. And Jesus mentions him in his letter, in his word to the church at Pergamum, that the people have killed believers, and he names Antipas by name. It's those people who've been crushed, defeated, murdered, martyred for their faith that John is seeing under the altar. And we should take that as God, as he views this, he sees their willing sacrifice of their life as a sacrifice unto him, right? And then those martyrs, they cry out, and you could say it this way. They say, how long, O Lord? They ask, Lord, to put it in colloquial terms, when are you going to make this right? And this is a common theme we see. Just yesterday, as I was reading in Psalm 13, the psalmist, I'll read it for you right here. The psalmist almost says the exact same thing. He says, how long, O Lord, this is Psalm 13:1, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? And so these saints, these followers of Jesus, are echoing the cries of God's people from generation before, saying, hey, God, these people have done wrong, and we need you to make it right. When is that going to happen? And their cry doesn't go unanswered. What does the text tell us? Let's look at it again. Verse number 11. Then they were each given a white robe, meaning God gave them the idea is that God sees them as pure and as holy and as worthy to be in His heaven. And they were told to rest a little while longer. In other words, hey guys, take it easy. Now, we don't like the last part. I'm going to be honest with you. It's tough. We don't like to read this. But here's what they're told. Until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves have been. What does that mean? What does that mean? More martyrs are to come. All right, so let's walk through. Seal 1, 2, 3, and 4. Conquest, famine, war, disease, as history marches on. And as history marches on, what is going to happen to people like you and me? There will be more martyrs to come.
ooh,
kind of strikes a different chord than the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel that some American false teachers like to propagate. Oh, just follow the Lord and he'll bless you in every way. Yeah, that's true. He will. That don't necessarily mean he's going to bless your bank account and everything's going to go good and your health's going to be okay and your neighbor's going to like you, and that when you share the gospel, everybody's going to be like, oh man, I'm so glad this is what I was missing in my life. No, what does Jesus say here? More of you will have to die before the end comes. It's a sobering reminder of the fate that many of our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ are dealing with just this very day, right? Then Jesus opens the sixth seal. Now listen to the words of verse 12 through 17. Listen carefully. And when he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth. The full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth, as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit was shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the king, listen to these words, then the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And listen to what they asked for, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come. Listen to the question they ask, and who can stand? Hey, that phrase, great day of the Lord, listen to me. It's used in Zephaniah, Obadiah, Acts, 1 Corinthians, 1 Thessalonians, I believe Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and a few others. And it all, every time it's used, it is representative of the, listen to me, in all caps, the end. Like, the end of the world. Okay? So what is this a picture of? I mean, just think about it. Yes, it's cataclysmic language. Yes, it's apocalyptic language. But what is being described here? The end of the world. It is a picture of the end. Go, listen to me. Go read Jesus' words on the end. Go read them. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have Jesus speaking about the end. And in Matthew, he has this, he kind of walks the disciples through this because they have several questions, and Jesus answers all of these questions. And right when he's about to tell them that here's the sign of me coming, there's this small little snippet where, hey, there's stuff that sounds very similar to what John is reporting he saw in seal number six. Here's the point I want to make this morning. It's not necessarily in the cataclysmic events, but it's in what the people who are enduring them say. What do they say? They would rather the rocks and caves crush them than to face God the Father and God the Son. And then they ask a crucial question. Who can stand? Now that question is going to be answered, but you got to come back next week to hear the answer to it, okay? Right? Because that answer comes in chapter 7. Who can stand? All right, so let's walk through it again. Seal 1, 2, 3, and 4. What do we have? Conquest, war, death, disease, famine. As history marches on, you can count on those things happening. As history marches on, what else can you count on? Followers of Jesus Christ will be martyred. And then what's going to happen? The end of the world is going to come. Right? What has just happened in seals 1 through 6? You have a picture of the rest of history. You can go back and look through Christian history, and what do you see? That scenario, seal 1 through 5, playing out over and over and over and over and over again. Right? So what here's the question I want to ask right now. We're kind of landing the plane here just for, and we'll be done in just a minute. But here's what I want to ask the question. What were, because remember, we've said from the beginning of this study that Revelation was written to real people in real places dealing with real problems in the first century. So here's the question I want to ask this morning. What were they supposed to get out of this chapter 6? Couple things real quick. Number one, I think when we just kind of talked about that, so we won't go over much of it in a minute. This is the arc of Christian history in one chapter. There will be conquest, there will be death, there will be war, there will be famine, there will be diseased. Followers of Jesus, there will be a portion of them who will be martyred. That's the arc of Christian history. Again, you can go back. There's a two-volume set by Gusto Gonzalez. You should get it. It's one of the best Christian history of the Christianity. This name of it. One's a red book, one's a blue book. It goes from Acts to the modern day when he wrote it. It's a great book. And what you will find in that is those five things happening over and over and over again. It's today. Today, there are in countries and in places. We have, like, you know, every year during Christmas, we do the Lottie Moon Easter, or Lottie Moon Christmas offering. That goes to international missions. A portion of that dollars goes to people who we can't even name in places that we can't even tell you. Why? Because it's illegal to be a Christian there. I remember one of my professors in seminary told us in his class that he was in China. In China. Not that long ago. 10 years ago. In China. Working with Chinese pastors and teaching them and educating them because they had no access. And so he goes over there and they have to smuggle Bibles in. And he goes in and they're literally in an apartment building, apartment bedroom, kind of like small space. And there's all of these Chinese guys and ladies all around and they're sitting on the floor and they worship and they sing in silence. Like, they're mouthing the words, but they're not vocalizing any sound, so their neighbors won't turn them into the communists. And he's in the corner with a hoodie on, like a middle schooler in winter, pulled down over their eyes, and he's got his Bible, and he's talking very softly about the scriptures for hours as they feverishly take notes. Why? Because they don't want their neighbors to find out. And they all go to jail. And that same thing happens today. What you see here is a picture of the arc of Christian history. Here's the second thing I think that they're supposed to get is that martyrs are not forgotten. The church at Pergamum where their brother Antipas died may be wondering what's going to happen to those who lose their lives for the cause of Christ. And Jesus here says they will not be forgotten. All right, and here's the last thing. This is not a trick question. But it matters. In this picture, in this thing, they asked who can stand, and I'm asking who is standing? Well, the answer is you got to go back to chapter 5 to find the answer. Because remember, John is talking to that elder, and he's fell down, and he's like, woe is me, the end of the world. And then the elder tells him, hey, the lion, Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, he can open the hand. And when John turns around, who does he see? The Lamb. Thank you, Tanner. And what is the Lamb doing? Is he seated, lying on the ground, rolling around? What's he doing? Standing. In other words, the Lamb of God, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, what is he doing? He is standing. He is in control. He is on the throne. He's not surprised. He's not overtaken. He's not going, oh man, I didn't know that was going to happen yesterday. Oh, I didn't know they were going to go through that. No, he is in complete and utter control. He's got it. Well, what's the song we all learned as kids? At least I did. He's got the whole world in his back pocket. No, in his hand. He's got the whole world in his hand. And for you and me today, that's exactly what we need to hear as well. Jesus has still got the whole world in his hand. Nothing catches him by surprise. He is still on the throne. He is still ruling and reigning supremely and sovereignly today. And listen to me, whatever we go through in life, it is not abnormal. It is not unique. Because Christians just like you and me have gone through these same things since Jesus burst out of the tomb and ascended back to heaven. Your experience, it may be new to you, but it is not uncommon to those who name the name of Christ. So what does that tell us? One, Jesus is in control, and two, He understands what we're going through because He too walked the earth and experienced life just like you and me. Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.